Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
Those of you who follow my shows know that I'm always pretty excited about my guests, and I am. I mean, after all, my wife and I select them and ask them to come on. Nobody else puts them on. But I'm unusually excited today about my guest, who's going to enlighten us about psychiatry, psychology, and is calling from Great Britain. So you're going to hear about the United Kingdom, and I think it's going to be really interesting. Before talking with my guest, I wanted to pick up on a topic that I don't get to talk about very much on this radio show, which is a big part of my life, and that is legal work involving someone who has either killed somebody or killed himself or herself on psychiatric drugs. I do criminal cases where someone's been on Paxil for 2 days and drowns their two children and himself in a tub. That's an example of a case I was involved in that was settled. Or I'll be involved in a case where someone has committed suicide, a little girl, let's say, a little boy, 10, 12, or an older person, and recently started usually an antidepressant, often in combination with Xanax. Some other benzo, but often Xanax, just common to hear Zoloft and Xanax and Paxil and Xanax and Lexapro and Xanax and so on, suicides. And this week, the case of a man, Jacobson, in Florida came up, and it just reminded me about this as I got on the show. Jacobson was a man who was taking Zoloft, and he shot his wife to death, apparently not in a confrontation. Shot her in the head, and then he killed his two twin seven-year-olds. I was called about the case, got a little brief about it, and said to the attorney, send it to me, and I'll have a look at it. Well, the attorney never sent the case to me, but loved having my name and put in the official record that she expected me to testify on this and that. This is the Jacobson case in Florida. And even my name got in the newspapers. Meanwhile, I hadn't agreed to anything. And apparently, partly because of my seeming presence in the case, rather than face that, they gave him life imprisonment instead of trying him for the death penalty they negotiated with him. Now he's trying to get out. Or to at least bring up these issues again. It's very interesting. I don't know much about the case, and I'm not going to comment on it, and that's what I told the reporter who called me. But I told him I'd certainly comment on the general issue. And, folks, we know that psychiatric drugs cause violence. There's a marvelous study by Moore, second author Glenn Mullen, two men I know and respect, where they went through all the FDA reports on violence and using a pretty high standard for violence. You can check it out. Put in Google FDA, Moore and Glenn Mullen, violence, and you'll get it. And what they found was that there was one drug that was particularly involved in violence, and it wasn't even a psychiatric drug. Varenicline, the smoking aid, was number one. Then after that came psychiatric drugs, the antidepressants, the benzos, and I believe the stimulants. And if you looked at other drugs in general, you found that hardly any drugs had more than one or two reports of aggression or violence as a possible side effect, while there were huge numbers, even factoring in the numbers of prescriptions for these group of drugs. So that one study confirms it. But there's lots of other material that I talk about in my book, Medication Madness, that confirm the drugs cause violence. We have the FDA admitting that many drugs are associated with violence now, not just the antidepressants, but the mood stabilizers, and of course a number of antibiotics have been implicated. I talk about all that, by the way, in my book, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal. For Lucy, my friend who's listening, I usually don't talk about my books. But I wanted to make that clear, and I wanted to say that I started out believing that no drug could make you do anything you don't want to do. I had this purist psychological free will view. Boy, was I naive. I was naive. This was even after graduating from my psychiatric training. And then I went back, and I'll tell you one of the simple, if you think that no drug can make you do anything, the simplest thing to do is go back and look at controlled clinical trials for any psychiatric drug. And you're going to find that the people taking the sugar pill rarely do anything bizarre, rarely get manic, rarely get psychotic, rarely get suicidal and aggressive. And then you look at the ones getting the psych drug, and you're going to find all sorts of craziness being perpetrated in association with the drug. And the groups are the same. They're groups of depressed people. They're groups of people diagnosed schizophrenic. They're groups of people diagnosed OCD. And here's the sugar pill group, and they're not going bonkers. Here's a psychiatric drug. And the most common finding out of clinical trials for psychiatric drugs, and I've never heard anyone say this other than me, but the most common finding, the only consistent finding in trials for psychiatric drugs, is that they make people crazier. There's no consistent finding they help people. It's highly, highly difficult to show they help people at all. But in every controlled clinical trial, they're making each other, making people nuttier, more disturbed, more distressed. So there's my little tidbit for the day. My guest is Lucy Johnstone. Lucy, are you there? Oh, you sound loud and clear. I met Lucy 20 years ago, and I just thought the world of her. I met her in Great Britain. I thought she was really intelligent, really dedicated, really thoughtful, just a terrific human being and a great colleague. And then I proceeded to hardly ever even communicate with her ever again. I don't know. What do you make of that? That's just the dumbest thing. Lucy's a psychologist, a trainer, a speaker, a writer, and, like me, a long-standing critic of the biomedical model in psychiatry. She blogs on Med in America and does really good blogs, really insightful blogs. The second edition of her book, Users and Abusers of Psychiatry, A Critical Look at Psychiatric Practice, came out in 2000. That's Users and Abusers of Psychiatry. Now out is the second edition, just came out a few months ago, of Formulation in Psychology and Psychotherapy. And the subtitle is Making Sense Out of People's Problems. It's co-edited with another person. Lucy and I had this discussion about how we proceed. Usually we don't proceed in that way on my show, but we thought we'd start out just talking about some general issues in U.S. and Great Britain, and then go on, and this I really want to do, and talk about Lucy's new interest. I'm not sure I'm going to be there on each of the on her complete formulation about this, but I'm really looking forward to it. She's very interested in psychological formulation, new ways to approach diagnosis. Lucy Johnstone, hello. I'm so glad to have you on.
Hello,
the show.
It's lovely to speak to you, and I'm not sure if I can live up to your introduction, but we'll have a go.
Well, it was 20 years ago. Maybe you're a little slower now like me. I don't know, Lucy.
I think we've probably both aged just a little bit, yes. But anyway, it's very nice to be in touch again.
I'm delighted. Well, listen, just talk to the folks about what you do, the way you're thinking about what's going on. You've been very involved as a critic of DSM, one of the most noteworthy in the world. Take off, Lucy.
Okay, well, I've been as busy as ever, I think, for you and for me and for a lot of other allies. This, you know, it's not something we can ever really let go, is it? We feel so strongly about these issues. But I have to say, at the moment, I'm feeling rather excited and optimistic about what's happening in the psychiatric world. I don't know if that's a view that you would share, but it does seem to me as though something may be happening, which, to be honest, I didn't think would happen in my career or in my lifetime, and it's certainly not going to happen overnight. But I'm really feeling as though the signs are that biomedical model psychiatry is facing some absolutely fundamental challenges. I don't think it's going to be able to survive those. And as we both know, you know, those challenges have always been around, haven't they, since the beginning of what we might understand of modern psychiatry. There's been a trend of thinking and people saying this doesn't work, these are not proper illnesses and so on. But I think things have really come to quite a crisis recently, along with the publication of DSM-5. So that's what's been preoccupying me a lot recently. I'd be very happy to talk a bit more about that.
Yeah, just keep going.
Just keep going? Okay, well...
Yeah.
Okay, so...
Tell us about what you're seeing and that you think is positive and what your role is in it.
Well, there's a lot I could say. The nub of the argument, and this won't be new to your listeners, of course, the nub of the argument is how we understand people's experiences of distress. And, of course, people's distress is very real. You know that, I know that, they know that better than anyone. People really do feel overwhelmed and terrified, and they hear hostile voices, and they have mood swings and so on. But the nub of the question is, how do we understand this? And almost universally, it's assumed by psychiatrists and other mental health professionals, but also by service users, because that's what they're told, and by an awful lot of lay people and journalists and the media and so on, that these kind of problems are illnesses, and we tend to use that language really without thinking about it. You know, all sorts of assumptions go along with that. These are biochemical imbalances of some sort that no one's ever managed to pin down, or they've got some genetic flaw that no one's ever managed to identify. So that kind of assumption leads to everything else, doesn't it? Leads to the idea that we need hospitals and medication as a mainstay of treatment and so on. And this is the kind of model that is underpinned by the diagnostic system, specifically by the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, which is the American one, of course, and ICD is the one that is sometimes used in Europe, the International Classification of Diseases. There's a quote from your book, Peter, Toxic Psychiatry, I often use in presentations, and it goes something like, if we didn't have diagnosis, psychiatry would become something hard to justify or defend, a medical specialty that doesn't deal with medical illnesses. Now, I think that sums it up exactly. If these aren't illnesses, then, you know, what the hell are we doing calling them, you know, just calling this a branch of medicine? That's what it comes down to. And in order to support that contention that these are illnesses, then we have to have a reliable and valid classification system. That's the kind of foundation of the whole edifice, if you like. If you take that away, logically, all the rest comes tumbling down. So that's why the controversies about DSM-5 are so important. And you're nearer the action over that side of the pond than we are, but we've read a lot about it over in the UK. As you know, DSM-5 has really overreached itself, I think. It's made itself look stupid by coming up with all these daft new ideas. Disruptive mood dysregulation disorder for children who have tantrums, you know, binge eating disorder for people who, from my perspective, like going out for a meal every now and again, perhaps eating a bit more than they should. So I think it's lost a lot of credibility, and I think the effect of that has been to raise questions about the whole thing. You know, if some of these diagnoses are ridiculous and made up, you know, what kind of credibility do any of them have? And as I'm sure you know, there's been a lot of controversy about the links that some of the members of the DSM committee have with drug companies, about the trials that don't seem to show that these diagnoses are any more reliable than the ones that they replace, and so on and so on. And most interestingly of all, from my point of view, is that some of the chief critics of this new edition of DSM, DSM-5, are the chairs of previous editions of DSM. So the chair of DSM-4, Professor Alan Francis, has been one of the most outspoken critics. Now, that has to be a bit embarrassing, doesn't it, if one of your main critics is coming from inside psychiatry, if you like. And I have a rather wonderful quote from him here. There is no definition of a mental disorder. I mean, you just can't define it. It's bullshit.
In one of your good blogs, Lucy, you point out that while he complains about the overexpansion of DSM-5, Alan Francis, the DSM-4, which he was the chair of and an inspiration of, overextended itself wildly.
Well, it certainly did.
Let me ask you something I wouldn't ordinarily ask.
Yes.
What do you think makes Alan Francis tick? Why is this great guy? And my wife talked to him on the phone on one occasion about coming on the show, and he said, "Well, you know, your husband and I don't really agree about very much." And I never called him, you know, just because it just doesn't seem to be the ambience of my show. But and maybe he wouldn't have wanted to and been uncomfortable. Mm. What do you think goes on with him?
Well, I've never met him. I've only emailed him. We had a blog debate fairly recently as part of his blog on www.psychology.com, I think. And I, you know, from what I know of him, I do have some respect for him for being willing to come out of retirement and, you know, challenge the excesses of DSM-5, partly because I think he genuinely feels bad about the overexpansion of DSM-4. We're clearly not on the same side of the debate, ultimately, because he thinks we should have diagnosis, but better diagnosis, and I think we should abandon diagnosis. But, you know, I think we might at least have a respectable debate together.
Yeah, he still supports drugging kids, which is, to me, one of the standards of whether you've had any enlightenment.
Well, I think there'd be very, very significant areas of difference between us, yeah, very significant areas, yeah. So that's what's been going on with the controversy, and I'm not sure if DSM can survive this. I'm not sure if there will be a DSM-6. It's quite interesting when you get the chair of DSM-5, Dr. David Kupfer, saying, "We've been telling patients for several decades that we're waiting for biomarkers." In other words, the evidence they've been telling us about for ages, the kind of the genes or the imbalances, the biological signs that show that these are illnesses, we're still waiting. So I really think, you know, the British phrase is the cat's out the bag, you know, the secret's out, you know, that people themselves are admitting that their best defense seems to be it's the best we've got, so we have to stick for it for the time being. Well, that's not good enough, and actually, as I think we're going to go on to discuss, we do have alternatives.
Well, I don't think, I'm not as optimistic as you. I'm sure there'll be a DSM-6 unless this one doesn't make any money. Because
that would be a start, at least.
Huge moneymaker. I mean, everybody's got to buy it. Gosh, it just got to keep the whole association afloat. So,
well, I know.
Drug company money.
That's another vested interest, isn't it? It's a great moneymaking machine for the APA.
It's huge.
Yeah.
Even
yeah.
I have to buy at least one. I think, Lucy, the change I see, I agree with you that there is some change in people being more skeptical about the DSM and so on. Where I'm seeing the biggest swing, though, is in the skepticism of the American public about drugs. When I used to do radio and TV, and I still do them, but I mean, in the past when I was doing them and doing public conferences and meetings, there was always some sort of attack against me. Now, it's mostly a love fest wherever I go and wherever I speak, and if anybody's critical, they do it very respectfully. I think there's been a sea change in the public's realization that something's gone way overboard. I don't think they've gotten the essential message, which is drugs, my message, drugs do more harm than good, do something else for yourself. But that's where I see the change. And I don't think it'll stop from internal criticism at all. Internal critics of slavery never stopped slavery. Internal critics of the communist bloc never stopped the communist bloc. They can always be crushed, set aside. It's the folks, the people finally saying, well, we don't want to do this anymore.
Yeah.
I think. Does that make sense to you?
It absolutely makes sense. I mean, both those parts of what you said make sense. The anti-drug thing, I mean, of course, not using diagnoses doesn't mean you never use drugs, but it kind of takes away the official rationale for them, doesn't it? These are not treating illnesses, and people like Bob Whitaker, I think, quotes your work a lot, have been very successful in spreading that message as well, haven't they? These drugs not only don't help, they do harm. And, you know, this is an absolute international scandal, but I'm interested you draw the analogy with slavery. I think that's a valid analogy, but of course you almost have to say these things cautiously because people jump down your throat and tell you you're an extremist. But the moral we can draw is that it's grassroots change that brings about, it's grassroots protest, isn't it, that brings about big changes. You know, the people themselves aren't going to give up their power easily, are they? But if
I think that's absolutely true.
Yeah.
You know, we're developing our own health system here, our own nationalized health system. By the way, you know, I'm probably would look to you politically like a dinosaur. I'm a small government guy. Talk about what happens to the delivery of psychiatry. That's one issue, and the other, psychotherapy and counseling under the healthcare system in Great Britain. I'd love to hear you. I asked Joanna Moncrief that on my show a few, not too long ago, and I think she was embarrassed because she didn't talk much about it.
Right.
What happens under healthcare to the delivery of services?
I'm very happy to talk a bit about that, and then perhaps I'd like to come back to how we're dealing with this diagnosis in my own profession in the UK, because that's also quite interesting.
I want to spend at least a half an hour, the second half of the show, talking about your very interesting new work. So we could start before then, but I guarantee you're going to get the second half of the show.
Okay, that's great. So, well, the situation in England, as you know, is we have the NHS, the National Health Service, which, I mean, I think I've always found that it's quite a difficult concept to get across to people from the USA because your system is so different, isn't it, that it is a national system. Nobody ever has to worry about whether they can afford to their health care, whether they can afford their operations or their medication, whether they can afford their surgery or whatever. I'm in the middle of watching that wonderful series Breaking Bad, and it struck me the whole plot hinges on the fact that, I don't know if you know the series, that the hero can't afford his cancer treatment. I mean, you wouldn't be able to have that plot set in Britain. So it's very different, and diagnosis is perhaps less embedded in the system in some ways because, you know, no professional has to use a diagnosis to get paid or anything like that. But the NHS in England is under attack with our current government, and, you know, this is a source of great anxiety and regret to a large number of Britons because it's often been said the NHS is the nearest thing to a national religion. We are generally very committed to it. It's being privatised quite rapidly, although not officially. But that's not true of the NHS in Scotland, Northern Ireland and Wales because it's run independently in what are called the devolved nations. And in fact, I work in Wales, though I live in England. So,
Lucy, let me ask you one thing as a long way.
Yeah.
You said that no one doesn't get something because they can't afford it. But isn't there a kind of rationing on what will be paid for?
Well, there has to be a rationing in any healthcare system. No healthcare system can afford to give everybody the most expensive medications, et cetera, et cetera. But I guess what we value about the NHS is it's absolutely not done on the basis the rationing isn't done in effect according to whether you can afford to pay for it or whether you can afford a decent insurance plan. It's done very strictly on, you know, the quality of the drugs and the amount of benefit it's like to bring to anybody, so to speak.
Okay. Let me push you a little bit in the direction I want to go. What happens to the delivery of psychiatry under national health care, maybe compared to the U.S., and what happens to the delivery of therapy and counseling?
Well, nearly all psychiatry and psychotherapy and counseling happens within the NHS. And, I mean, I guess there are, you know, psychotherapy has always been a bit of a poor relation within psychiatry. There's always been not enough access, and people have always said it's not easy enough to get talking treatments. You know, of course, if you can afford to pay, there is a private business, if you like, outside the NHS. And what you can get tends to be kind of fairly narrowly packaged, so it's cognitive behavioural therapy, CBT, and that seems to be coming in more recently, along with privatisation. There seems to come sort of, you know, fixed amounts of therapy delivered according to certain diagnostic categories, you know, which, you know, is a more medical way of looking at it. I call it medical model psychology. I don't think it's a helpful way to go. So things aren't looking too good, I would say, in the NHS in general. And
see, that's my concern about what's probably going to happen in the U.S. Because I know people who come to see me occasionally from Canada. I don't usually take long-distance consultations. And it's very hard for them to get any kind of therapy there that's real therapy by our standards. And also, the psychiatry there is even worse in some ways. I mean, they're more openly doing psychosurgery right now. And so I think that's one of the liabilities of having a national health service. Would you agree or not agree with that?
I'm a Brit, and I'm very, very passionately committed to the NHS.
I think that's what I ran into with Joanna Moncrief, too. So when I'd ask her a question about what happens with therapy and psychiatry, she would say that she pretty much wouldn't discuss it and say
she's a supporter.
I understand.
Of course it's not perfect, but I would say at least you have a reasonable chance of getting free therapy in the UK, you know, whereas my understanding is that in America you really pretty much have to apply and rely on being able to afford it. That's my understanding, but that might be a misconception.
Well, one of the things we have here is a growing number of people who are offering therapy without being in the system. And that's going to make it cheaper and cheaper. And I want to help. I'm wishing, and I'm trying to work on models with various people for this, because I believe you could train good therapists without their ever going to college or even having graduated high school. If there were good people experienced in life, I think you could train them in a year with nothing more than supervision and role-playing and a few simple techniques and hardly any reading. So I think that we – and I do think more and more people are deciding to just be life coaches and take other roles where they're essentially doing therapy. And I think that's going to be the future under our as we nationalize our health care, which I'm afraid is going to happen. I mean, we're sort of looking at the potential collapse of Obamacare, but nothing really ever collapses that's got that much money in it already. So I think we're going to move in that direction, and I'm looking at alternatives outside the system, hoping that they will play a powerful role. But it's interesting to me how much some of my friends who I consider to be very intelligent, sophisticated, that you do love the healthcare system, even though I don't want one here like that. I do hear that. When I was in England, I got way back, 10 years maybe, I got the feeling that it was almost like one of the things that held together the Brits. Instead of patriotism, it was their national healthcare system.
I think that's probably very true. Yes, like I said, it is a bit like a national religion. It really does. It's something we feel immensely proud
like
of.
Like a patriotism.
Yeah, yes. Been with us since 1948, you know, and the next government may restore, undo some of the damage that's been done. We don't know, but it's certainly... You know, there's a lot of destructiveness going on at the moment for ideological reasons.
Why is that? In a minute, why is that? And then we'll go to break. And when we come back, folks, Lucy Johnston is going to talk about some really interesting, innovative stuff she's doing. But in a word, why do you think? Is it just cost that it's just so costly, or do you think it's pernicious?
No. I hope you don't believe those rumors. No, the NHS has been shown many times to be one of the most cost-effective healthcare systems in the world, as well as one of the fairest. Again, remember, I'm a Brit. I feel very strongly about this. It's to do with, you know, turning it into something that businesses can make money off. So that's how I would see it. It's an ideological thing, really, to make money for big business, our Prime Minister and his wealthy friends. I hope I'm not going to get locked up for saying that, but that is my view and the view of a lot of other people.
I hope that's still not at a risk in Great Britain, that you could get locked up. Lucy Johnstone. I'm really glad having you on. Folks, this is Lucy Johnstone. Her latest revised book, 2013, last year, is formulations in psychology and psychotherapy. And that's what we're going to talk about when we come back after the music and after the break. And this is Dr. Peter Breggin. Welcome back to my get-together with Lucy Johnstone. You can check her out on, it's spelled like I'm saying it. I hope I'm saying it right. It's
Johnstone.
Lucy, I unleash you to just tell us about your new interests.
Okay, as a preamble to that, I want to talk a little bit about something else that's making me feel very, optimistic and excited, which is about some work that I've been involved in along with my professional body, which is the Division of Clinical Psychology, which is a subdivision of the British Psychological Society. So the Division of Clinical Psychology represents the UK's 10,000 clinical psychologists. And I have been a member of a working party for the last 2 years, which really kind of linked into a lot of this DSM controversy, has been deciding that we as a profession need to take a position about diagnosis. I think it's fair to say that a lot of clinical psychologists in the UK have always been pretty sceptical about diagnosis, and many of them, I think, would say that they don't use it at all. I would certainly say I don't use it, that language. I hope I don't use that way of thinking. But it's something a bit different to have a position on that as a whole profession. Of course, that's quite controversial. Nevertheless, nicely timed to be released along with DSM-5 in May last year, the Division of Clinical Psychology released an official position statement. So this is now the official position of my professional body. I've got a quote here. The DCP is of the view that it is timely and appropriate to affirm publicly that the current classification system, as outlined in DSM and ICD, has significant conceptual and empirical limitations, and there is a need for a paradigm shift in relation to these experiences that the diagnoses refer to towards a system which is no longer based on a disease model. So translated into ordinary language, it's saying we need to abandon, move away from psychiatric diagnosis and the whole illness biomedical model, which I think you'll agree is a pretty radical and brave statement to come out with.
Lucy, I'm actually impressed hugely. I don't think any psychological association in the U.S. would say anything like that, do you?
From what I hear, it'd be much more difficult in the U.S., but and it's quite a big deal over here. We have one of the main Sunday papers that ran it on its front page, for example, and there's been a lot of publicity. And, it's been fantastic from my point of view. There's been a huge amount of debate and, of course, a lot of criticisms. The usual things people say, oh, so you're blaming people, oh, so you're trying to pick a professional fight, and so on and so on. But I really think it's kind of reorientated the debate in quite a significant way. And as a society, we want to build on that. And so we've got two documents come out this year. I'm not very closely involved with either of them, but essentially they're about building on this work. And one of them's about the experiences that we call depression. One of them's about the experiences we call psychosis. And they're both evidence-based, quite careful overviews about alternative ways of understanding these experiences. How can we understand these in psychological terms, not medical terms? So we really want to push this agenda forward. So that's been pretty exciting.
Go ahead.
And,
that's Great work. That's all I wanted to say.
Thank you. So that's good. One of the recommendations we made, as if we're not going to have diagnosis, of course diagnosis isn't going to vanish overnight. It's going to be with us for quite a while for all sorts of practical and logistical reasons. But one of the recommendations we made is that, we already have alternative ways of working, which clinical psychologists have used for many years, in fact. And one of them is psychological formulation. And I'm not sure how familiar that a term that is in America. Is that a term that you're familiar with, or
no?
No. Okay.
No, it's not actually a common term here at all.
Oh, interesting. Okay. I blogged about it on Madam America. But essentially, this is a core skill for all clinical psychologists and, interestingly, for psychiatrists trained in the UK, although they tend to view it slightly differently. And essentially, it's a term with a certain amount of credibility, if you like, and acceptability in services. And essentially what this means is that we sit down with service users and, based on the evidence and the research and our clinical experience, that's what we bring to the process, and based on their account of their life story and their feelings and the sense they've made of their experiences, we put together a kind of psychological summary, a sort of narrative, but it's an evidence-based narrative that we both agree on, which will probably be two or three paragraphs long, which we share, which is collaboratively drawn up, which is open to revision, which we come back to and build on, and we call that a formulation. And the idea, the main purpose is to guide the intervention. The idea is if you have a really clear idea and a shared idea about what's going on, then you've got a much better idea how to proceed. But there are all sorts of other helpful messages, I think, that go along with the formulation, which is that it's centrally about personal meaning, whereas, of course, diagnosis, I think, removes personal meaning. It's about looking at ways you can take control of your life rather than giving the message you're the helpless victim of an illness. It's about including social circumstances and relationships rather than blending it all in your biochemistries. It's not an expert view that's delivered on you. It's something you share. It includes your strengths. It's very much about what you can do. It's not just what can be experienced as a rather devastating verdict on what you can't do. So it has all sorts of advantages, depending a bit how it's done. Of course, you can do these things well or less well, but depending on how it's done. And when I'm in a provocative mood, which I quite often am, I say that that this is a kind of antidote to diagnosis, if you like. You know, it puts back what diagnosis takes out. The damaging messages of diagnosis, I think, can be kind of counteracted by the use of formulation. And that's the subject of my the second edition of my book, Formulation in Psychology and Psychotherapy, looking about how we can actually apply this. So that's all.
Is anybody routinely approaching things in that manner? Because it's really inimicable. That's quite a word, but it's really doesn't mix with current psychology and psychiatry practice in this country.
Well,
to actually include the patient or the client in the formulation is mind-blowing. Yeah. I do that. If I have to make a formulation.
Does it happen in services? I bet it doesn't. Well, that's interesting because the way most psychiatrists see it is they see this as a kind of addition to the diagnosis, so it sort of fleshes out the diagnosis. Now, a couple of years ago, I led a working party to flesh out for my profession, clinical psychologists, what we mean by formulation, so it didn't get defined in a way that, you know, was really just a kind of icing on the cake of the medical approach. And we have decided that for us, and again, this is quite a radical thing to say, formulation is an alternative to diagnosis, not an addition to it. You know, it seems to me, both in theory and practice, that the more complete a formulation you have, the less you need a diagnosis. And they are opposite to each other. They don't actually go together very well because one is, in essence, saying you're suffering from an illness with medical causes, and the other is saying you're suffering from the consequences of difficult life events and relationships and things that have happened to you. So, in a way, it doesn't fit in the system very well. But if I can talk a bit more about my favourite subject, there's a way of using team formulation which I think actually helps to bring about culture change and to not only work better with individuals but help to shift whole services and whole teams towards more psychosocial thinking. And here's something else I've blogged about. I've become very interested in it recently. It's actually quite a growing practice. I've done training all over the country on this particular use of formulation. It's called team formulation. And the idea in this is that as well as having a formulation one-to-one with the service user, if they're in the right frame of mind to do that, you have a whole group of professionals involved with the service user or a whole team putting together a shared understanding in exactly the same way, drawing on the evidence, our experience, and having the same kind of summary. One of the definitions of that is a collaborative process of making meaning together. So a theory based on psychological and social evidence about the causes of people's difficulties, a sort of collective best guess. And this is a way of capturing team intuition, team ideas. It can be a forum for ironing out differences of opinion, be it counter-transference feelings of stuckness, anger, failure, frustration. You know, staff typically feel all these things, and that's useful information if it's handled right. It tells you something about the service user and their difficulties. And so in my current service, I gave a presentation on this morning, actually, in my service. We now have this process running on a weekly basis in just about all parts of the service. So that's community teams, inpatient wards, rehabilitation service. So it's a kind of very different way of looking at things implanted within the basically fairly medical service. And one of the interesting things is how much staff love it. You know, it's spread because the staff really want it. And, you know, to pay tribute to my current colleagues, medical colleagues, they've been very supportive of this process. And what's interesting to me is that, I don't say most of the things that I'm saying to you now. I go in very much pro-formulation, and I'm very cautious about being explicitly anti-diagnosis. But what tends to happen is that the diagnostic language kind of withers away, because we actually find more helpful and interesting and relevant and appropriate ways of understanding problems. So in my own team, we now regularly have multidisciplinary meetings, including psychiatrists, where for a whole hour, nobody need mention the diagnosis. We can actually come up with a plan based on a much more sophisticated understanding of what people's difficulties are. So that's
this is wonderful. Wonderful, interesting, practical intervention. Do you notice any lessening of medication at all as a result of having these formulations?
Well, on an anecdotal day-to-day level, I do notice, a number of different effects. One, that a number of people can actually be discharged or have their input significantly reduced, just because, you know, it's quite easy to get into very unproductive relationships with people where they're not being helped and we're not really helping them. And a number of other people have recovered, you know, in a way that wasn't expected. Now, your question is very relevant, because one of the things I think we need to do is produce some kind of evidence that this approach has very concrete effects, like less medication and fewer admissions and higher recovery rates. And there's a certain amount of evidence that supports the use of team formulation, but it's a new practice. A lot of the evidence we don't have yet. That's one of the next things I want to look into. You know, we've got a great many clients have been through this process now. It'd be really interesting to do a kind of overview and see, does it seem to promote recovery? Does it seem to reduce costs and all that kind of stuff?
Well, I think this is a marvelous new approach to helping from within the establishment. It's such a problem, though, you know. You can do good like you're doing, but I think there's always that limit, which is when they catch on to what the implications are,
Yep. They
run into a lot of resistance.
Well, I have come across resistance in some places. To be my current colleagues, you know, I've encountered very little resistance, but certainly there has been, yeah. I mean, there's a point at which it absolutely doesn't fit, isn't it? It's a question of how far you can go. I agree. And I think to some extent it's a model that's designed for use within the system. I think, you know, you might want to do it quite slightly differently or setting up a system from scratch. But given the systems we have, I found it really quite a powerful way of achieving at least a degree of change.
I think it's a great idea. And how much do the patients, I guess they're called in the health service, right?
Yeah.
How much do the patients participate?
Well, it's very, very important to involve them as much as possible. So in a sense, it's two parallel processes. It's our work with them, perhaps on a one-to-one basis, to understand from their point of view their difficulties, and our teamwork to understand what we see is going on. And the two processes are a little bit different, because the teamwork often includes a lot of kind of anger and frustration and so on, which needs to be in the team formulation, but it wouldn't be appropriate to share that directly with the client, and vice versa. The client or patient may have a lot of quite personal stuff, and that you don't need to share all those details with the team. So they're parallel processes that feed into each other. The team view feeds into the service user view. The service user view feeds into the team view. It's an ongoing process.
Can you imagine pushing it to the next level and the patient is a member of the team?
Well, some people do it like that. Yes, some people do it like that, and you know, that has its advantages. Yeah, I mean, again, it's one of the things I've been thinking about, whether we might reach a stage where that model also seems an appropriate one, at least, you know, or a more appropriate one. Again, it's about, you know, a lot of this is about converting staff in a way, isn't it? A lot of it's about shifting staff attitudes at quite a fundamental level, which I think to some extent that has to happen separately, or at least that's how it's worked out at present. And perhaps if I could say a bit more about... Sorry.
What happened... Oh, it's okay. I would think that including the patient in the psychological formulation and the ongoing treatment as a part of the team, and really I would hope the final word in the team in terms of saying, no, I don't want this or that, that would just be the key and transform things. Is anybody getting close to that?
Well, the thing about formulation is you can do it in all sorts of different ways, yes, and our professional guidelines certainly say that, you know, one of the key factors is this is as genuinely collaborative as you can possibly make it, given there's an inevitable power difference, if we're honest about it, and that we should always be respectful of the service user views, you know. So if the service user says that's not right, you know, we have to listen. Of course we do, whatever our own views. If the service user doesn't agree with that, doesn't find that helpful, it's not a useful formulation. So in that sense, we're really trying to even out the power balance as much as one possibly can within the existing system, and certainly a lot more than you do within diagnosis.
Yeah, I mean, if I were setting up a retreat, or, you know, I guess what I'd probably call it, or a haven, if I was setting up a place where people came for help in that way, I would want it to be just like therapy, which is between me and that person, and they get a say about everything, including whether they come and what I put on the health forms and what I write about them if they're getting disability. And I would think that would be the best model long term for what you're doing.
Well, no, of course it would. And I mean services in England do have much more than they used to have, service user representatives on sitting on committees and being part of interviewing panels and so on. You know, there's still a way to go. That does happen much more. But one of the things about working, as I do, very much at the kind of acute end, is that many of the people we see aren't ready for, able to use, or wanting therapy. It's very often not about therapy. It may be about someone in a really acute, what you might call psychotic state, who perhaps for a while can't sit down and talk to us, or is tormented by unusual beliefs and so on. So in that case, I think a team formulation is particularly useful, because even especially in those situations, we have to have a psychological understanding of what's going on. We don't just say this is psychosis, bring on the drugs. And in that case, situation, people actually aren't currently able to collaborate, although we hope they will be at some time in the future. But meanwhile, we have to have a plan. Meanwhile, we have to have an understanding. So that's one of the ways in which it's useful. And the theory, the model on which, from my perspective, formulations need to be based, I mean, this kind of links into what we talked about earlier, is what are the alternatives? There's a kind of emerging model, I think, which is a very powerful and evidence-based alternative to the biomedical model. So if you say, what do we have instead of diagnosis? Well, one possible answer is formulation. If you want to say, what do you have instead of the medical model? Well, I'm sure you're aware of this, but there is a huge amount of emerging evidence about the very strong causal impact of all sorts of adversity, trauma, abuse, social factors like poverty, unemployment, inequality, and so on, but particularly on trauma and abuse, and particularly in the kind of more severe presentations of things we call psychosis. These are understandable reactions to traumas, is part of the emerging model. And it's based on
a mixture
of...
I was writing about that three decades ago.
I'm sure you got... that's absolutely true. That's absolutely true. Yeah, I mean, I'm afraid you've been ahead of the game for many years, Peter. But I'm pleased to tell you that...
But other people were too, you know. I mean, one of the interesting things is that... Yeah. It's just so hard because psychiatry just runs over it, and academic psychology runs over it. But when I wrote Psychology of Freedom in 1980, I was presenting a trauma, stress, model. I call it the basic stress paradigm for all emotional disturbance. And
yeah,
I mean, the problem is that, you know, we come back to these ideas, but then we filter them through the establishment, and they don't go anywhere. Not to be discouraging, Lucy.
Well, you're being realistic, and you're absolutely right. You know, there's a number of eminent people in this field who said we need to keep rediscovering this stuff. You know, I think we seem to be in a period of rediscovery, a cycle of discovery, which is a good thing. And there'll be many people like yourself who've been saying this for decades and much further back than that. But there's recently been an editorial in the British Journal of Psychiatry, which is our most prestigious psychiatrist journal, saying, you know, we need to take very seriously implications of the all this evidence about how all sorts of trauma abuse massively increase the risk of your suffering from some kind of serious breakdown. Not that that's automatically the case in everyone, but
yeah, the feminist movement itself, the feminist sociologists, psychologists, back 20, 30 years ago were generating evidence about sexual abuse of women and men when they were interested in men and its association with pretty much every known disorder.
That's absolutely true. Yeah, that's absolutely true. And I guess what I'm saying is it seems to be emerging in the mainstream, you know, establishment journals.
No, that's good. Saying,
surprise, surprise. You know, which has to be a good thing. It seems to be we're entering a cycle, I hope, when it's easier to talk about these things openly. It's not just kind of, you know, less powerful groups trying desperately to put this on the agenda. And we've got some interesting new findings, I think, from neuroscience about how, you know, how do people encode memories of extraordinary distressing events? And it appears, you know, this is not my area of expertise at all, but it appears that really overwhelming events can be encoded in a different way than other memories. They get fragmented, and this may account for some unusual experiences like hearing voices and so on. This may be a kind of dissociation in order to survive overwhelmingly traumatic experiences. So that's an evidence-based, generally biopsychosocial model, but the bio bit, you know, has some credibility and makes some sense. It's not all this kind of unevidenced nonsense about biochemical imbalances and so on. So I think that's the power of this recent version of the theory. The additional information we have about, you know, neuroscience and stuff on attachment theory and so on.
Well, this is a very, very good talking with you. It gives me a little more optimism about changes going on. I think that we need just a drastic break with the old way, because that old way has been dominating us for 300 years.
Yeah.
And there isn't going to be an accommodation with it. It's going to
have to be a break. There's no possible compromise, is there? You know, well, we've had a kind of very unhappy compromise for decades, but actually it doesn't work, does it? We need a complete change. Yeah.
Well, there are practical compromises like what you're doing, introducing the psychological formulation into the institutions, and I think that's a fine thing to do. I couldn't stand it because they'd throw me out in the first day because I always say what I believe. God bless me with the,
well,
for that,
I find
I guess,
it hard.
But
I find it hard at times.
I'm sure you do. Now, we've got about 2 minutes left, and anything more? This is not like a summary, but we've got about 2 minutes left, two and a half, I'd say. What would you like to just keep that in mind and tell us some more about your thinking?
Well, I think to sum it up, not just what I'm saying, but what a whole load of people are saying, particularly service users, survivors, many of whom, you know, I've got a lot of inspiration from, people who've been through the service, come out the other end, rejected their diagnoses, decided to kind of make their own story of their lives. You know, a very powerful saying that they frequently say and that I often use is, instead of asking what's wrong with you, we need to ask what's happened to you. I mean, I think that really sums it up to me. It's not something wrong with you. These are normal reactions to unusual and distressing events. Things have happened to you. They may have driven you crazy, but you can recover. You can find hope. You know, you can take up your life again. often the price of that is that you have to leave psychiatry behind. Unfortunately, that often is unhelpful rather than helpful, but it certainly can happen.
What I like to tell people when they, my patients or my clients or the people I talk with ask me, well, what's my diagnosis? I say, I want to know your story, and I want to help you change it for the better. Your diagnosis. It's your story.
I'm glad you said that, because 20 years ago, Peter, maybe longer, I remember someone in the audience asking a long, complicated question about some client they knew and what are you going to do about that one then, and your response, I remember this clearly, was to say, well, I'd want to know what is his story. And that is the essence of formulation, actually. What is the story?
Oh, that's lovely. Lucy, let's not let years go by. I'll email you some thoughts, and it's just been a pleasure to have you on the show. Lucy Johnstone from the United Kingdom. She's easy to Google. She's got a second edition out of her book, which our second half of the show has been about, Formulation in Psychology and Psychotherapy, Making Sense of People's Problems. Thank you so much for being on the show.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.